From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 261 with guest Aiden Finn, recorded Monday, April 2nd, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and you're listening to Run As Radio. With me today, my guest is Aiden Finn, and he's an MVP in virtual machines. Aiden works for Micro Warehouse Limited, which is a Microsoft value-added distributor, as a technical sales lead evangelizing Hyper-V, System Center, and Forefront to Microsoft partners in Ireland. He's been working with systems management technology since 1996, and his experience with Windows Server, desktop deployment and management, System Center, virtualization, and so on. He blogs at aidenfinn.com, that's A-I-D-A-N-F-I-N-N, and tweets as at Joe Elway. Okay, we're going to have to explain that, and has written and contributed books such as Mastering Hyper-V Deployment and Mastering Windows 7 Deployment. Welcome, Aiden.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, the Joe Elway one always brings up lots of questions.
Yeah, where did you get Joe Elway's tweet from?
Okay, so when I was back in college, back in the early 90s, we got internet access for the first time. We were told never to reveal our true names on the internet.
No kidding.
Yeah, true. And I was on some BBS in some university in America. I think it was called ISCA BBS or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And every username I tried to come up with was already taken. And I ended, I'm a big American football fan, or a football fan as you would call it.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite quarterbacks at the time were Joe Montana and John Elway. So
there you go.
Joe Elway. That's where it came from.
Oh, and you synthesize the two. Joe Elway.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, because Joe Montana was taken, John Elway was taken.
Right.
So I thought, okay, no one's taken Joe Elway yet.
Funny.
And it's kind of stuck with me over the years.
I'm with you. You know, way back in the 90s, I registered the domain name g.com because, let's face it, there was not a lot of three-letter domain names, and now there's none.
And it's worth money.
And it never goes away. You just don't. You know what? I'm just going to keep that. You know, with a three-letter email, it's like I have a nine-character email address. Those are rare to come by.
Very.
So, obviously, Hyper-V, a big part of your focus. Have you been taking a look at Hyper-V changes that coming in Server 8?
Oh, yeah. Ever since WPC last year, when the first announcements about Windows Server 8 came out, they told us about the increased scalability, as the figures were back then, and Hyper-V Replica. Been very excited. And then I was lucky enough to go to the Build conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 3 days in Hyper-V cloud storage and clustering goodness. The announcements that just kept coming were like mind-blowing for us who've been working with Hyper-V since the start.
So what's the story with Hyper-V Replica? What's its purpose?
So Hyper-V Replica is a disaster recovery solution for a couple of different scenarios. And the core scenario is the small, medium enterprise who just can't afford to do disaster recovery right now.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't afford the storage solution, so the SAN,
yeah,
that has built-in replication. They can't afford the bandwidth that goes with that. Or they can't afford the host-based replication solutions that can be like $4,000 or $5,000 per host.
Sure. Well, and let's face it, when it comes to SANs, you're talking, if you get in under $100,000, it's a miracle.
Yeah, and then you're looking at the license as well for the replication.
Sure.
And then there's the dark fiber with the low latency link.
Yeah, and you are talking about remote replication. Like, I have another data center and I want to keep this synchronized so that I can fail to a different site.
Exactly.
Okay.
So think of those small, medium businesses that were in New Orleans and got wiped out.
Yeah.
Or in Northern Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Or wherever around the world they were hit by fire or flood or volcano. You know, the big enterprise is able to recover from that, but the small business isn't. But Hyper-V Replica is going to enable that. And then the other scenarios are, so the small medium enterprise, there's actually a few scenarios as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have two offices. They can use one office as the DR site for the other and vice versa.
Right.
Or they could replicate to a hosting company and use HTTPS authentication, so a simple SSL certificate, to authenticate into the hosting company. So that hosting company could be a Microsoft partner.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a hosting company with infrastructure as a service. And it opens up new opportunities for Microsoft partners who are doing managed services for those small, medium businesses. And then the other scenario is for the enterprise, a large corporation who has branch offices with Hyper-V servers or clusters out in the branch office. And if they want to do disaster recovery for them, they can do it on a budget by enabling Hyper-V replica back to the data center.
Cool. Okay, so what is Hyper-V replica actually doing? Are we basically streaming the changes?
It's a very clever solution. I have started referring to it as being elegant because it's on the face of it, it's a very simple design. I'm sure the code is not simple. In fact, I'm very sure the code is not simple. speaking as a person who is a qualified Hello World coder. So what Hyper-V is doing is it's intercepting writes to the VHDs or the VHDX files.
Right.
We can come back to that one later. And it's streaming those writes and updates to a log file. And then every 5 minutes, it replays that log file over to the disaster recovery site.
Hmm.
Here's where it gets clever. It replays it in reverse. So it gets the last write. So it's not replicating needlessly writes over the same block.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So you take that 5 minute chunk and a given block might have been written on 10 times and only the last write matters.
Exactly. Because you don't care about the previous nine.
Sure.
And it's designed to work over commercial broadband.
So with its unreliability and its latency, you know, all those kinds
of things. Exactly. So there's no automatic failover. It's a manual failover because with commercial broadband, you do get frequent outages.
Sure.
And if you had an automatic failover with a heartbeat, the heartbeat would fail during that line failure.
Yeah, you'd be failing over all the time.
Exactly, and needlessly failing over.
You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of log shipping in SQL Server.
Yeah.
That same kind of concept of you're taking a snap of the log every so often, hauling it over and applying it, but it's a warm failover solution. Somebody has to choose to switch.
Exactly. So that's where working with a hosting company or a partner and can help, especially one that has knowledge of your environment. You know, they're a phone call away. And you think about the whole disaster scenario. You make that phone call. They can have you up and running in seconds.
Theoretically.
They literally right-click on the VM and say start up. Or maybe they have an orchestrated task using System Center Orchestrator to start up a stream of VMs in the correct order.
So what state is the receiving VM in? Is it usable or when it's receiving these logs?
It's in an off state.
Right.
So it's powered off. And you simply right-click on it during the disaster when the other machine is offline and bring it up.
Now, you still have the issues of, you know, if it's a website, how you point the DNS and so forth. But the main thing is you have a within 5 minute copy of the system.
Yeah, it's primarily going to be looking at your internal servers that you're trying to get up and running. You might not be too concerned about external DNS updates. But that's something, obviously, you'd have to work with your hosting company to get sorted out, or your DNS registrar.
Now, is there any effort to try and synchronize these log blocks across multiple VMs? Say I have an application that runs on three machines. I want it to be in a consistent state?
It's actually, no. Each virtual machine is configured and replicated independently.
Okay, that's fair. Just so we know, you know, this is not a transactional integrity for SQL Server.
No. Though it does include VSS for those applications that you need to be able to do consistency for, so it's an optional setting. And normally we wouldn't need to turn it on. But they're saying it's one of those things that if you do find there's an application during your testing that you need to enable a VSS setting for, then you would enable it.
Sure.
And there's a few other nice tricks in there as well. So we can keep multiple copies of the virtual machine in the disaster recovery site. And then when we invoke, we can actually pick which one of those we want to power up. So we don't have to go with the latest copy. We can actually go with an older copy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what's it doing? Is it not just automatically applying the log? It's key here, chronology of the logs it's received, so you can choose when to step in?
Believe it or not, it's using snapshots from the destination site.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's using Hyper-V Snapshot.
I mean, now you're starting to give me ideas on how I don't even need to go to use this for DR. This might be just a backup strategy locally where I'd be able to roll back a VM to a certain state.
Yeah, but the best solution would still be to have a backup solution like Data Protection Manager.
Right.
And do the site-to-site replication of DPM. Hyper-V replicate snapshots never really should be used for backup and recovery.
Right.
Unfortunately, we do encounter people from time to time who do that, and they end up filling hard disks and having virtual machines go into a pause state.
Just because they're out of space.
Yeah, luckily enough, with Windows Server 8, one of the nice additions or changes is we get live snapshot merging for the first time.
Hmm.
So currently, if we delete a snapshot, we have to power off the virtual machine for that ADHD file, which is underneath the hood, to merge. But with Windows Server 8, it will just do that while the virtual machine's running.
Nice.
Yeah.
It does seem that there's a bunch of step-ups for Windows 8 Hyper-V.
Yeah. The team listened to the market. When I'm speaking, I always tell people that the Hyper-V group are probably the most receptive to feedback.
Hmm.
And they've heard of a lot of feedback. So snapshot merging was a pain point for people. And another one was nick teaming. So up to now, we've had to rely on nick teaming from the OEMs.
Yeah, it's always a third-party tool to be able to team multiple NICs together.
Yeah, and then we had to follow their guidance precisely to mm-hmm. configure the NIC teaming. If we got it wrong, we had to rebuild the host. And then if something went wrong with networking, we really had a complicated support relationship with both Microsoft and the third-party OEMs. But in Windows Server 8, we get NIC teaming built in.
Nice. Well, and it's the same problem with like RAID controllers where you lose that hardware, you're trying to recover that array, you've got real problems. And I have the same issue with custom NICs. It's always that problem. As soon as I go third party, it's like, you better buy two of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And the NIC teaming side of things is really cool. I've been playing with it in our lab.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky enough to have some nice networking to play with. So I've been teaming 410 gig NICs to get 40 gig of bandwidth.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, doing live migration over that is a dream. Another nice addition or change we get is concurrent live migration. And here's the sweet thing. It's not limited to 4 concurrent live migrations. It's limited to whatever you can get over your bandwidth.
Interesting. So you're literally talking about multiple machines migrating simultaneously.
Yeah, I've been testing by migrating 20 virtual machines over a 10 gig NIC.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was a dream.
Well, and just how often do you see a 10 gig NIC pinned?
Well, what you're starting to see now is because hosts are getting bigger and bigger,
mm-hmm.
and we're getting so much memory into our hosts. So recently, I found that the cheapest configuration in terms of cost of ownership over 3 years was a 5U server with 4 10-core Intel processors. And as much memory as I could get in there as possible.
So which is an amazing gigs. Amount of memory these days.
Yeah, 512 gigs of RAM at a reasonable price. Instead of going for those 32 gig DIMMs or whatever. And when you want to do maintenance on that host, if you're doing live migration or vMotion or whatever
right.
over a 1 gig NIC, think about what's actually happening there. You're copying and synchronizing the memory over that network cable.
Yeah.
So realistically, you want as fast a connection as possible. So whenever I'm asked about if you should use 10 gig, I say yes. Where should I use it? I say first place you should think about using it is your live migration network.
Right.
Because then you can do work on that host more quickly. So if I've got to drain a host of 512 gigs of memory, if I do it over 10 gig, it's going to be X times faster than it would be on a 1 gig NIC.
Mm-hmm.
If I start that maintenance mode on a 1 gig NIC, I might come back to that host in a couple of days' time.
Well, it's just so much data. You know, these VMs are so big now.
Yeah, and think it's not just a straight 512 copy either, because you've got a synchronization to go across there because the virtual machines are still running.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially, a live migration or a vMotion could actually go through that copy process up to 10 times as it dwindles or as it works its way through the memory as it changes and the pages are marked as clean or dirty.
Yeah.
So if you put in a lot of bandwidth, you can speed that process up. And now with Windows Server 8, where we're looking at, 56 gig networking, potentially. You know, we're looking at some serious throughput here.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
But
Those big data center deployments where they're trying to squeeze as much as possible into a piece of tin to reduce the cost of electricity, to reduce the cost of rack space and power, and even licensing. Putting in big pipe can actually be cost effective.
Sure. Well, and you know, just thinking about that machine you described, that 5U chassis with 40 cores and 512 gigs of RAM, like, is one of the reasons it's becoming so cost effective is this is what the cloud is running on. Like, you talk about what machines are they selling tons of. It's got to be these machines for cloud infrastructure.
Exactly. And Windows Server 8 is the beyond virtualization platform.
Really sort of, I feel like an awful lot of what they're doing over in Azure has been pushed down onto Windows.
That's exactly what's happened. So they've taken our feedback and our wishes and our demands, and they've combined it with their own learning from running Azure and running their own cloud processes.
Mm-hmm.
So they've understood they need to implement multi-tenancy. They've understood that they need to build network security into Hyper-V rather than relying on the physical network.
Right.
So for example, you know, we can only have so many physical VLANs in a network to segment and secure a network. And VLANs were never really intended for firewall security. They were intended for broadcast domain. So now we're getting things like port ACLs and PVLANs within Hyper-V.
Yeah.
And the Hyper-V extensible switch.
Well, the whole virtual switch model is really interesting. I think people get themselves tangled in knots configuring networking in Hyper-V.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that happens. I've had a number of situations where I've had to help people out. In fact, I've got one lined up for tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
where the networking thing gets a little complicated for some people. They've been reading documentation that's not really applicable to Hyper-V.
Right.
Maybe it's applicable to SQL clustering, but they just read the clustering piece.
Yeah.
And there's a certain configuration that we have to do. There are certain connections we have to enable within a Hyper-V cluster. And to be honest, in Windows Server 8, it's still the same.
Mm-hmm.
But how we accomplish that is changing significantly. So we're getting a whole host of network enhancements in Windows Server 8, in particular for the Hyper-V and cloud scenario, so be that public cloud or private cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the cool things we're getting is the converged fabric. So if you want to implement 10 gig networking, but you're working on a budget, you can put in two 10 gig ports into your Hyper-V host.
Right.
And if you look at the new generation of servers that are coming out, that's exactly what they have. And from those two network cards, we connect them into the Hyper-V extensible switch. And from that, we divide up the bandwidth for all the different connections. So the parent connection, so we can remotely manage the host operating system.
Right.
As some people would call it.
And when we really talk about converged fabric, we're talking about being able to provide as much bandwidth as necessary at that moment for those devices.
Yeah. So we have QoS built into Windows Server 8.
Mm-hmm.
So we can carve up the connections and set minimum or maximum policies. We can provide a certain SLA on our bandwidth.
Right.
We can say that iSCSI is always guaranteed a minimum amount of bandwidth, but it can burst beyond that if it needs it and it's available.
Right. Well, and it's counter to, I think, the reflexes of a lot of experienced IT people who prefer isolation.
Yeah, and that model is still possible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a position where you're able to physically isolate, you still can.
Yeah.
However, a lot of people are probably going to go towards a more converged fabric, and they're going to engineer the networking side of things using QoS. For the network guys, this is actually nothing new.
No.
So this is stuff they've been doing for a long, long time. But the possibility is there. One of the great things about Windows Server 8 Hyper-V is we have options.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, we've really only had a couple of different architectures. And if you strayed away from those architectures, bad things would happen.
Yeah, you get yourself into big trouble.
Yeah, live migration wouldn't work. Your backup would be ineffective or would slow down production or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting options and we're getting protocols to help us enable those options like DCP or data center bridging
mm-hmm.
enables iSCSI and normal LAN traffic to reside on the same NIC. QoS is helping us to put in an SLA We get things like receive-side scaling and DVMQ to help us optimize the performance of our networking, whether it be virtual or physical. We're getting SRIOV, so that's a new protocol that's being added.
And what is SRIOV?
So it's single root I/O virtualization.
Sounds
and
serious.
What that allows us to do is bypass the parent partition, that where the extensible switch normally resides in user mode, and a virtual function in the physical network card is presented directly to the virtual machine. So it allows us to get a great throughput through to the virtual machine. And what's great about this is we can live migrate that virtual machine to another host that doesn't have that type of network card with zero downtime.
Yeah, and you now you touched on some great issues around building out this infrastructure. You know, it's all well and fine when we design it in the beginning and all our hardware is symmetrical and all the features are symmetrical. But as soon as the system gets a little older and we've bought some newer gear and different features and things, the migration behaviors get much more challenging.
It is, yeah. The great thing that Microsoft that promised us with Windows Server 8 is no new features that break live migration.
Right.
And that's very important. So the example with SRIOV is a perfect one because right now there's a limited number of network cards and servers that actually support SRIOV. So you need motherboard support, you need firmware support, you need network card support and driver support to enable SRIOV. And that quite at the moment, that's limited to high-end hardware. But it's just like VMQ was a few years ago. It's one of those things that'll work its way down.
Yeah, everybody will support this eventually.
Exactly. It's like a new feature in a high-end car. Eventually, it works its way down to the hatchback, the rest of the drive.
I remember when the virtualization chipset features were only in high-end servers too, right?
Yeah.
So
and now they're in laptops.
Yeah, you can't get a machine without it. Whether it's turned on or not is another question. But I like this idea of we really do need to advance the NIC. You know, more of these things need to be intrinsic to all NICs.
Yeah. The networking side of things is critical to being able to design a flexible and powerful cloud. And whether it be public or private. And the amount of work, so you can see the amount of work when you start reading through the features. Like things like SRIOV and RDMA, which most of us don't have in our hardware yet. But over the next few years, the hardware will have that functionality and we will be able to take advantage of it. Because Windows Server 8 and Hyper-V will be ready for it.
And yeah, we'll just see it and use it and that'll be all there is to that. It feels to me like Microsoft's playing less catch-up with VMware these days and more doing their own thing, kind of innovating for the way their customers want to use stuff.
Yeah. And that comes from what you mentioned earlier, which was they've learned a lot from their own cloud. As I hear some of the guys locally in Microsoft Ireland saying, Microsoft is probably the only company that actually does operate its own public cloud and provide software for a private cloud.
Right.
So they're in a unique position to learn from one and apply to the other. And yes, they have done some things that the competition have never thought of before. And in some ways, they've actually leapt ahead of the competition. So great example of that is the VHDX file. So the virtual hard disk, or VHD, has been around for quite some time.
Sure.
People who've used virtual server would be familiar with it, and virtual PC and would be familiar with it. And it's been with us up to now. And it's had its limit of 2,040 gigs,
right,
just under 2 terabytes, which is the same as a VMware VMDK file. We have a new format called VHDX, which is 4K sector aligned. So we get better performance on those bigger disks. And it allows applications to store metadata in there. So VHD is not just a virtual hard disk, it's also a container. And it scales out to 64 terabytes.
Nice.
Yeah.
That does feel exactly like, boy, you guys learned this one in Azure, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. So that big data that you want to put into your private cloud, you're going to be able to do that on Hyper-V. You're not going to have to chain together lots and lots of just under 2 terabytes VHDs or use pass-through disks.
Yeah.
Hopefully, pass-through disk is going away. Because VHDX apparently is going to have better performance than VHD, VHD was near physical disc format performance if you used fixed VHD. And when we talk about the big scalable stuff, mm-hmm. you look at the new figures for Hyper-V. So a cluster will scale out to 64 hosts. An individual host can have 160 logical processors. So strictly speaking, well, not strictly speaking, but in server virtualization, mm-hmm. that's 160 cores in the host.
Yeah.
16 10-core Intel processors. We can have 2 terabytes of RAM in the host, 1,024 virtual machines running on that host.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Each virtual machine, 32 virtual CPUs, and 1 terabyte of RAM.
Yeah. I mean, those would be stunning machines on their own.
Yeah, they would. These are big workloads that we wouldn't have virtualized before, but now we can.
Well, and you get back to this idea of, aren't we better off with more smaller VMs, that just from a redundancy perspective and a portability perspective, than these titanic? I mean, a terabyte VM is terrifying. How do I move that? How do I care for that?
Over 4 10-gig NICs that are teamed together.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that's what it's going to take.
Yeah, or your 56-gig networking or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're looking at big workloads. And if you look at the Azure model, they tend to go towards lots of small virtual machines.
Yeah.
And you certainly can do that. But there are certainly workloads out there that tend to be fewer machines with lots of processor and lots of memory. We have to be able to handle those, and we're able to.
This section of Run As Radio is sponsored by Secret Server, the password management software for IT admins. Secret Server helps you manage local admin passwords and service accounts the right way. Get your free 30-day trial for Secret Server at runasradio.com/secret-server.
I have to wonder if, and I presume when you talk about the 56-gig workloads, you're talking about stuff like InfiniBand.
Exactly.
I just wonder if that's going to become mainstream. You know, it used to be the realm of just pure HPC kind of work, but bit by bit, you know, as Ethernet's banging up against its own walls, you're seeing more and more discussion about using InfiniBand as regular production infrastructure.
I can see it in public clouds. I can see it in very large data centers where they want to make the most of their ability to move workloads mm-hmm. or to connect to storage. So, in theory, some of the stories I'm hearing now about what we can do with SMB 2.2, disk is actually becoming the bottleneck rather than the network.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have this new functionality that we're able to store virtual machines on a file share, and it's supported.
Right.
Thanks to SMB 2.2. On a 1-gig network, it will match, maybe even beat, iSCSI networking.
And that's just on a 1-gig network?
Yeah. So 1-gig versus 1-gig, it'll match and maybe even beat it.
Now we get back to this question of, you know, is iSCSI becoming obsolete?
Well, maybe. From a Hyper-V perspective, it could.
Yeah.
It comes down to one of these, well, it's an option thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the choice of using file shares or the scale-out file server, which is an active file server cluster with storage behind it.
Yep.
We can store our virtual machines on there if we want big, scalable, economic disk. Or if we still need that physical storage like a SAN that has those additional features that only a SAN can do,
yeah.
We'll still use iSCSI or Fibre Channel or whatever. So we do have choice. This is the great thing.
Sure. But I still wander back to that, you know, we started this conversation talking about replica for SMBs. It still feels to me like the SMB style solution is a pair of sturdy Hyper-V hosts using a shared storage device, whether that's iSCSI or Microsoft Storage Server, possibly even, you know, just 10 gig bonding with SMB 2.2.
Well, down the road, it may actually be something similar to what you've just discussed.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that the hardware manufacturers are working with Microsoft on something called a cluster in a box.
Right.
Which is a pair of file servers and JBOD, just a bunch of disks,
yep.
in a single chassis. And from this, we can create a scale-out file server, which is that active file server cluster.
Right.
So if one of them blows up, automatically the clients of that cluster flip over to the alternative node.
Yeah, it might be some DFRS layered on top of that as well.
Yeah, it's very clever stuff. And then in front of that, we could put our Hyper-V hosts. And instead of them using iSCSI or FibreChannel or SAS, they just store their virtual machines on a UNC path.
Yeah.
And I've got it working in our lab at work. It works beautifully.
Yeah, and it's always a question of what can I fail and what can't I fail? Like the ability to knock that machine out and have it recover automatically is always an interesting equation.
Yeah, and the design is elegant. There's a witness process that works within the ScaleApp file server architecture and SMB 2.2. So if one of those servers in that file server cluster break, the Hyper-V hosts automatically just flip over to the other one.
Right.
Because in the back end, it's actually using cluster shared volume. So it's an active file share or file store. So there's no waiting for disks to fail over or anything like that. So we actually have the same levels of fault tolerance as we would have in a SAN.
Without having to buy the SAN.
Exactly. It's a much cheaper tier of storage. But, of course, we do lose out on those other features that a SAN can do, like volume snapping and hardware-level replication, so on and so forth.
Yeah, SANs do get you something besides a SAN administrator.
They do. But a lot of companies out there feel like they're held hostage by their SAN salespeople.
Sure. Well, because the answer to every problem is buy more SAN.
Yeah. It's buy more disk, and it's an expensive addiction.
Sure. And I don't know that it's, you know, you got to remember that this guy's motivated by making his sales numbers each month. So what else did you think he was going to say?
Yeah, and he does not want to sell you a JBOD with a couple of file servers in front of it.
No.
Because he's not going to make his number that quarter.
Yeah.
But it's another tier of storage. It's fault tolerant. Mm-hmm. It's scalable. It performs well. You put in your networking correctly, your disk that's running at 15K will still be the bottleneck, which is great. You may end up looking at SSDs and thinking, wow.
Yeah, maybe I got to go here. Or heck, Fusion IO boards. Like, there's ways to make disks go really, really fast.
Yeah. We've got a lot of options in the next few years. I think those of us who are engineering and architecting are going to have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
In all levels of industry.
I know I'm certainly having fun, and I'm looking forward to Windows 8 server growing up and shifting us up another level.
Yeah. Everybody's who's been playing with it is really excited. From the techies like me, who love playing with Hyper-V, the System Center guys are, you know, drooling at the moment with the recent CTP of Service Pack 1 for System Center 2012. And the PowerShell guys are having fun because they've got hundreds of commandlets to play with in Hyper-V. Like myself, I'm no PowerShell guru, but I wrote a script which would deploy an entire lab for me in a matter of seconds.
Awesome.
Yeah. I'm now working on a script which will actually read my VM configurations in from a CSV file. So I can just open up a file in Excel, put in the specifications that I want for my virtual machines, and the PowerShell script will read that in and deploy the lab for me.
Nice.
Yeah. Automation's great.
Yeah. PowerShell's awesome for that.
Another reason for people to go learn PowerShell.
Yeah. If you haven't already immersed yourself, you're missing out.
Yeah. As I'm realizing over the last couple of weeks.
Sure. Well, and there's such a great community around it. We've done some awesome PowerShell shows. There's plenty of people out there willing to help you.
There are. And there's some great guys out there. I'm lucky as an MVP, we get access to the PM who oversaw the PowerShell side of Hyper-V, and he's been really great with us, and he's been doing some training with us.
Awesome.
So we can pass on that information to the community in general. So, yeah, it's been interesting getting into PowerShell really for the first time and seeing the power. And, you know, to be able to build an entire Hyper-V cluster using PowerShell, then be able to deploy all your virtual machines on that using PowerShell.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty amazing to be able to just kick off a script and then just sit back and call your boss over and say, hey, look at this. I'm able to put my feet up and relax because the work I've done is making sure everything's done in a nice, you know, controllable and predictable manner.
Well, Aidan, I think we're just about out of time. Any last shout-outs? Where can we see you speak?
Speak. speaking at the moment. I'm not actually doing any speaking at the moment. I'm hoping to get into a new Hyper-V book. Myself and a few other guys are doing some thinking and talking about what we're going to do with a new Hyper-V book and how we're going to approach it. We very much want to give people something very, very technical and deep.
Yeah, and I love a good book for Hyper-V for SMB. I think that's an awesome topic.
Yeah, we're thinking very much covering all aspects, but getting deep inside. You explain how things work inside and then work your way out. I think people have a better understanding of why and how and what things to avoid.
For sure.
And that's kind of lacking out there in the moment. Kind of how I like to blog. Occasionally, I write a white paper on my blog as well. Mm-hmm. Where I delve into things like iSCSI and clustering or dynamic memory and just show people here's the best way to take advantage of these technologies.
Nice. Well, Aidan, thanks so much for talking to me.
No problem, and thanks for asking me on.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.